Thank you. Be seated. The Navy has taken Justice Gamage from us, but he will participate in the argument and decision of this cause. The court is pleased to recognize the student council of Gill Elementary School in Dallas that is here observing arguments in our final cause for the morning, which is William Palmer as independent executor of the state of Boone M. Moore, deceased, and others, versus the Cobble Wall Trust Company, Incorporated, in Elwood Cluck from Bexar County. The court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument and is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Hall for an argument from petitioners. Mr. Hall has reserved 7 minutes for a full rebuttal.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am Tom Hall, here representing the petitioners. This is an appeal of a jury verdict of a negligence, deceptive trade practice act, and breach of fiduciary duty case tried in probate court in Bexar County. The Court of Appeals reversed sua sponte, the judgment in favor of the plaintiffs, on the grounds that the probate court did not have subject matter jurisdiction of this case. I would like to address, first of all, the issue raised that there was no estate pending to which this cause of action could appertain. The respondents here argue that there is no subject matter jurisdiction because there was no estate pending at the time of the institution of this suit and the entry of judgment herein. It is interesting to note that there were 54 points of error brought forth in the opening brief of the appellant respondent herein, but that issue was never addressed prior to the rendition of the opinion in the Court of Appeals. The arguments in favor of the pendency of an estate to which this cause of action could appertain are fivefold. Initially, the respondent argues first in its supplemental brief in this court that an order of September 1986 closed this estate, and that when this suit was filed in November of 1987, that the estate was no longer active. The record in this case clearly defies that assertion. The order that is referred to in September of 1986 is an order which closes a temporary administration of the estate by the Cobble Wall Trust Company.
Well, the Court of Appeals focused on the fact that the assets were depleted, and because the assets were depleted, the estate was no longer an active pending estate.
That is the Court of Appeals position, Your Honor.
Is that incorrect?
That is incorrect.
The assets had not been depleted?
Assets were not depleted, and one of the assets of the estate was a substantial chosen action, as is demonstrated by the judgment rendered in this case. There were actually two estates that were pending at the time of the commencement of this trial and at the time of the entry of the judgment. One was the estate of Boone Moore, decedent. Bill Palmer was the independent administrator of that estate under an order appointing him in April of 1986. As the record will reveal, Mr. Bill Palmer was appointed as the independent administrator of the estate of Marie Davis on the morning of the commencement of the trial. She was an individual plaintiff prior to the commencement of the trial who had become deceased. In fact, the record will reveal, volume 1, pages 19 through 38, that the trial was actually recessed for 2 days because of an objection lodged by the defendants and the respondents herein that the decedent was not represented by an administrator. So at the time of the commencement of this trial and at all times forward, there were actually two estates to which this cause of action could appertain, that of Marie Davis and that of Boone Moore. The evidence that the estate of Boone Moore was an active pending estate after the September 1986 order is demonstrated by the record generally, and specifically by Plaintiff's Exhibits 7, 8, and 9. The estate tax at the time of the commencement of this trial and the commencement of this cause of action had been paid, but there were still ongoing negotiations with the Internal Revenue Service. Bill Palmer was actively participating as an administrator of this estate, was dealing with the Internal Revenue Service, and the closing letter for the estate was not even received as the record will demonstrate, until September of 1988, substantially after the commencement of this cause of action. The estate of Marie Davis, I don't even think there is an argument to be made that that estate was closed at any time during the pendency of this cause of action. The Court of Appeals cites the opinion of Gutierrez versus Gutierrez in support of the fact that there has to be an estate to which this cause of action can appertain in order for jurisdiction to lie in probate court. The Gutierrez case clearly addresses the issue of the importance of the existence of an estate, not only at the time of a hearing, but at the time of the entry of the judgment. I don't think the argument can truthfully be made that at any time prior to the commencement of the trial and the entry of the judgment, that whether or not there was an active pending estate is relevant. I don't think this is a situation where jurisdiction is a threshold inquiry. The Court of Appeals expressly, in its opinion at page 12, acknowledges the fact that this estate had not been formally closed. I think the Court of Appeals' argument is that it's just a de facto inactive estate. The respondents herein clearly make the argument in their supplemental brief that there was a formal closure of this estate, which is defied by all of the actions of the probate court judge. It's defied by the fact that the record here demonstrates that there were at least one other and maybe two other active pending cases in probate court in which the estate of Booney Moore was a litigant. I think it's clear, although the order of September of 1986 is not before this court in terms of the transcript, it was not brought forward by respondents, and it's really not formally before this court. I think it's clear from the statement of facts that what that order does is simply close the temporary administration. There were still ongoing business matters that this state was actively involved in, the IRS and other litigation. I think clearly that this record demonstrates that that estate was active at the relevant times.
Mr. Hall, if you're correct and the record bears out your assertion, can you tell us what limitations, if any, there are on the jurisdiction of the probate court to litigate any and all causes of action, given the fact that the state is open?
The short answer to that is no, I really can't tell you. The cases are not uniform in the standards that they lay down. We've got those early cases of C versus Hall and Yole v. Piper Aircraft that were decided before the 1985 amendment to Section 5A of the Probate Court. And basically what those cases set forth as a rule of decision with regard to what kind of cases can be litigated are that whether or not there is a sufficient nexus between the probate administration and the litigation. Clearly we know that just because the probate administrator is a party to the litigation is not sufficient to establish jurisdiction in probate court, but the cases are not uniform in telling us. Those personal injury cases that have been tried in probate court, such as that English v. Cobb case and the other one, C.V. Hall and Yole, are all personal injury cases. And the ruling in those cases is that there's not a sufficient nexus just because the primary cause of action in that case survives to the beneficiaries of the estate and not the estate itself. That's different from the situation we're dealing with here.
Is it your contention that the district court and the probate court have concurrent jurisdiction?
I think they do in this case.
And therefore, if you guess wrong, limitations is not told by the pendency of the suit, or is?
Talking about statute limitations?
Yes.
I think that the filing of the suit would toll the statute, if I understand the question.
In either court, even if the probate court was later determined not to have jurisdiction?
Well, I think that your remedy in those two situations is differently. I think that if you file it in probate court and you guess wrong, then you cannot get it jerked up in the district court. If you file it in district court and it's abated, then the probate court can reach out and grab the litigation and bring it down into probate court.
But let me try my question. Maybe my question is not clear. If you guess wrong and file in probate court and the case is dismissed for want of jurisdiction at some point, can you then refile in the district court, or as limitations period continued to run during the pendency of the case in the probate court?
Are you asking whether the limitations is told by the filing of the suit in probate court?
Yes,
that's the question?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that question. With regard to the subject matter jurisdiction, I do want to address that more at length.
Well, before we move on to limitations, would limitations have run here? Assume you're, assume we affirm the Court of Appeals. Not that we are, but it's one way or the other to make that assumption. Would there be a bar because of limitations for you to refile in district court?
I really don't know. I haven't looked at that issue, to tell you the truth, but I think that the Court of Appeals is of the opinion that it would be. I mean, it was a rendition of judgment by the Court of Appeals. But I really have not looked at it. With regard to whether or not there is subject matter jurisdiction in the probate court of this litigation, I think that if you look at the existing case law now, that it's clear that there is. As is set forth in the brief, all of the cases that are relied upon by the Court of Appeals to decide, and I think the Court of Appeals really, as I read it, it's a little confusing, but as I read the Court of Appeals' opinion, it's saying two things. A, there's a de facto closure of the estate, so there's no estate to which this lawsuit can appertain, and B, that there's just no subject matter jurisdiction, even if there was an active pending estate. All of those personal injury cases that the Court of Appeals' opinion cites, in my opinion, are sufficiently dissimilar to the important issues which focus on the nexus between the probate court and the probate administration and the litigation, to where I really think that it's factually distinguishable. The only case that is even close factually to this case at bar that's cited by the Court of Appeals' opinion is that Farah v. Fashing case, which is the case that, that involves indemnity and contribution from a bunch of lawyers that were involved in the probate administration. And ultimately what that case held was that there was not jurisdiction because there was not sufficient relationship between the litigation and probate court and any augmentation of the estate assets. And even under that rule in Farah v. Flashing, it's clear that if you apply that rule to this case, that it would, in, it would act in favor of jurisdiction because as a party to the litigation, the estates of Mooney Moore and the estates of Marie Davis, as is demonstrated by the judgment, would stand to augment the assets of both of those estates by virtue of collection of a judgment rendered in favor of those parties. The Court of Appeals did not address the Bunnell versus Jordan case, which is cited in the brief. And I will represent to the court that I cannot distinguish that case factually from this case.
How about by the jurisdictional statute of the El Paso Probate Court? Does that distinguish that case?
I don't, to me, it does not, Your Honor. That was not an issue, as I read the Court of Appeals' opinion, in terms of the decision of whether jurisdiction attaches or not. That case, as this case does, alleged causes of action for negligence, breach of fiduciary duty, and violations of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act against a lawyer that was involved in a slightly different capacity than the lawyer who was the defendant in this case. But the issues were exactly the same, it seems to me like. And if you read the Court of Appeals opinion carefully, it seemed like there were a lot of factors in that case that would mitigate against assertion of jurisdiction. In fact, the court addresses that issue and says, it's not clear to us whether we have jurisdiction of all of these issues and all of these parties, but in cases where jurisdiction is doubtful, what we're going to do is presume in favor of jurisdiction. And that language is cited in the brief. Even though that case was cited in the application for writ of error, the supplemental brief of the respondent herein does not address that case. And I just do not see how that case can be factually distinguished from the case that we're dealing with here. It's the same causes of action. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry A. McClenahan will present argument on behalf of the respondents.
May it please the court, there have been several issues that have been raised both in the Court of Appeals and in argument here this morning, each of which I want to address. First, I think it would be helpful to put, although I don't want to go into a long rendition of the facts, there are several dates that are important in this case to determine whether or not there was an active estate and whether or not the cause of action in the case at bar was necessary for the settlement or dispersion, distribution from assets of that estate.
Will you keep in mind what I'm interested in also after you recite these, the sequence of events, at what point did you, for the very first time, challenge the jurisdiction of the probate court to proceed on this cause of action, as you recite that?
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, in the trial court, the lawyer who handled the case in the trial court did not challenge the jurisdiction of the court. However, it's well settled in the law that a jurisdictional matter can be raised at any point, and in fact, the Court of Appeals itself picked up on the jurisdictional issue and addressed that point, making the other points unnecessary to rule upon. The important sequence of events are these, and there are only a few dates that I want to highlight.
So back before we start,
yes.
Let me be clear. The Court of Appeals, sua sponte, wrote on this jurisdictional point without having been raised to the trial court or at the appellate level by your side.
It was not raised on appeal in the Court of Appeals. It was not raised as a point of error in the Court of Appeals.
It was not raised in the trial court either.
It was not raised in the trial court either as to the jurisdiction of the probate court. The Court of Appeals did, in fact, raise it sua sponte. That's a correct rendition of what happened. On November 22nd of 1985, probate court number two, presided over by the late Judge Burris, entered an order authorizing implementation of an estate plan for Booney Moore. It is important to note that at that hearing, objections were heard, or discussion was had. All of the parties, that is, Dardeman, Davis, and Garner, represented by their attorneys, approved of the plan. The court approved of the plan. The next important date is, and the guardianship for Booney Moore was established. Booney Moore then died on December 12th, 1985. On December 13th, the trust company, Cobalwall Trust Company, was appointed as temporary administrator of the estate, and of course upon her death the guardianship estate was closed. By the end of the year, the estate plan had been substantially concluded by the selling of transfer of some property and the selling of some bonds, which we can talk more about in just a minute. The next important date is March 11th, when there was an independent administrator appointed for the estate of Booney Moore. On April 9th of 1986, after having filed a final accounting, the court, after hearing objections by Mr. Palmer and others, entered its order approving the account and final settlement for the guardianship estate, which of course was closed upon Booney Moore's death, that matter being put to rest. Then on September the 10th of 1986, the court entered another order after again hearing objections and after hearing on the merits, entered an order approving the accounting and discharging the Cobalwall Trust Company as temporary administrator of the estate. What happened then in probate court, too, with regard to the estate of Booney Moore was nothing. With regard to this matter, for 14 months until November of 1987, when Mr. Palmer and Dardeman, Garner, and Davis filed this suit against the trust company. In the intervening period, there was nothing going on, and in fact, as the appellate court correctly points out, the assets of the estate had been distributed in a what could be called a companion case. This estate, Mr. Palmer also sued San Antonio Savings Association, who was to foreclose, had posted for foreclosure the property which was the subject of this estate plan.
Counsel, before you proceed to some other point, let me ask you a question with regards to the argument the petition made that there were some pending matters, and those were negotiations with the IRS or settlement of the taxes that they were due. So perhaps no proceedings were ongoing in court. The administrator had some business to take care of, and that is negotiations with IRS and others.
That's right, but there was not a probate matter proceeding in this court. And in the case of Pullen versus Swanson, a case out of the 14th District Court in Houston, that court said that a probate proceeding must already be pending in the court, and the court is not exercising jurisdiction unless and until the matter is actually pending in that court. And if this were not so, a statutory probate court could arguably assert jurisdiction over any cause of action that fell within the broad definition of incident to an estate. The importance of that is, where there is an independent administrator appointed to probate an estate, many of those states are never closed. They may remain open in that they are not formally closed by court order for years and years and years, and nothing happened in there at all.
What do you have to say about the second estate, Marie Davis?
The second estate, which, as counsel mentioned in his opening, that Marie Davis died on the eve of trial, or on the first day of trial, and in fact, Mr. Palmer was appointed as temporary administrator of her estate. That's not the estate that was bringing suit initially, nor is that the estate that the probate court was addressing at all through the time of the trial. The estate and the property that they are claiming that they were trying to get was property that they were trying to get for the estate of Booney Moore. And in fact, there was no property. Let me, if I might, in response to that question, just back up a minute. We often use the word estate very loosely. That word estate is well defined in the probate code itself. The estate is not an entity. Estate refers to the real and personal property of a decedent in this case. The real and personal property of the decedent. The real and personal property of the decedent in this case had in fact been transferred out when a guardianship was set up before her death. That guardianship estate held title to the property, and that title was transferred in pursuant to the estate plan, which was approved by the court in November of 1985. The estate of Booney Moore had no property other than the proceeds that they had received, which had been distributed and used to pay estate taxes, that is, proceeds from the sale of the bonds. Again, Pullen versus Swanson indicates that there must be a matter pending before the probate court, and nothing was pending before this probate court between the time the temporary administration was closed by order of the court and the lawsuit in 1987. In fact, the Court of Appeals, the court below, correctly stated that this was not an active pending estate in probate court. Let me move quickly to the point that Judge Cornyn raised about the limits of jurisdiction. Even if it were found that there were a matter, or that there was a matter pending before the probate court, the limits of jurisdiction have been addressed and readdressed both by this court and by the legislature. The seminal case relied upon by the court below is the case of Say versus Hall. I might note to this court that that there were 1985 amendments, of which I'll speak in just a moment. There were also 1987 amendments, which could arguably apply, but in this case, they would be applied retroactively according to the legislative history, but they don't have any effect on this case, as correctly pointed out by the court below. So we're operating under the 1985 amendments. Say versus Hall, an important case. In Say versus Hall, an action brought in both wrongful death and survival action, the court, Justice Kilgarland writing for the court, said that appertaining to an estate or incident to an estate, language right out of the probate code, were designed to limit the jurisdiction of the probate court to matters in which the controlling issue was the settlement, partition, or distribution of the real and personal property of the decedent. I'm substituting that for the word estate. That the court found that claims by and against an estate could not be construed to include wrongful death or, and they said in dicta in the Say opinion, unliquidated claims. That's an important word in that Say opinion because apparently it caused some confusion. What was meant by unliquidated claims? Did the court mean any unliquidated claims? Because there may in fact be unliquidated claims that bear directly on the settlement, distribution, and partition of the estate. So the legislature in 1985 amended the probate code to address that very issue. In the 1985 amendment, the legislature sought to clarify that unliquidated claims as well as liquidated claims, if they were the controlling issue for the settlement, partition, or distribution of the real and personal property of the decedent, would in fact be properly raised in the probate court, and jurisdiction would lie. In fact, this court recognized that in the Yowell versus Piper, a case that was previously cited to this court. In the Yowell case, although that opinion, after the court delivered it, sometime subsequently, as I understand it, the case was settled, the opinion withdrawn. But that court, in a footnote to its opinion, recognized that since the Say opinion had issued, that the 1985 amendments had gone into place and were in fact applicable. But that court said in its footnote that even applying the 1985 amendments, that amendment was not intended to expand the jurisdiction of the court, rather to clarify, those are my words, not the court's, but that the court, even with the 1985 amendment, the survival action would still not be properly brought in probate court. That would be a matter for district court. That legislative history, in fact, of the 1985 amendments, which I think are important here, the 1985 amendment, was further explained by the Dallas court in the Quest Microwave case, which is cited in the brief. In that case, the Dallas Court of Appeals noted that it was not the intent of the legislature, again, to expand the jurisdiction of the probate court, but rather to clear up confusion that had been caused by the language in the Say opinion, where the court made some reference to unliquidated claims, that to clear that language up, to indicate to those of us trying cases at bar that jurisdiction was not expanded, but that the probate court could in fact hear unliquidated claims where those claims were made by the estate or against the estate, and where the controlling issue, again, was the settlement, partition, and distribution of real and personal property of the decedent. That's not the case at bar. This case at bar is not one to recover property, either real or personal, for the estate. Mr. Palmer attempted to do that in the case Palmer versus San Antonio Savings Association, where he tried to enjoin San Antonio Savings Association from foreclosing on the property, again, which was part of the estate plan. In that case, the Court of Appeals, the Fourth Court, went through a longer version of the rendition of sequence of events that I have provided the court here today, and recognized that the guardianship estate was the estate that had, by approval of the court, by specific order of the court, taken possession of that property, that guardianship estate, in implementation of the estate plan, had mortgaged the property. They had received $2.4 million. When I say they, I mean Dardeman, Davis, and Garner, and the estate to pay taxes. That $2.4 million went for the benefit of those beneficiaries of the estate, and that they could not, in fact, because of estoppel as well as other reasons, they could not in fact go back and undo what had already been done in the guardianship estate. In that case, jurisdiction was proper in the probate court, because in that case the estate was trying to recover property that had been in the estate, recover that property back into the estate for the settlement, partition, and distribution. Clearly, that's not the case here. The case here is brought under the DTPA and negligence. It is a remedial action, one punitive in nature, a claim which the beneficiaries, in fact, have outside the probate court. It's not one that is necessary for either the settlement, the partition, or the distribution of the real and personal property of the decedent, that is, the estate.
Counsel, do you have a position on the issue I asked Mr. Hall about regarding whether if the plaintiff guesses wrong and files suit in probate court and it's later determined that court did not have jurisdiction, is limitations told or does it continue to run?
Your Honor, like Mr. Hall, while I have not researched that specifically, I do have an opinion. My opinion is that, in fact, limitations would be told during that period if he filed in the wrong court, and he would have a saving period of 30 days, I believe, to refile once it was determined. But I'm here to tell the court that I have not researched that issue.
Is that a judicial admission?
No, Your Honor, it is not a judicial admission at all. Again, I have not researched that particular issue, but it is my opinion, again, that they may, in fact, have a saving period of time in which to refile in the district court if it's determined that the original court did not have proper jurisdiction.
Counsel, with regards to what statute is applicable here, do you concede that this case should be decided under the 1985 amendment to the probate code?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the 1985 amendments are, in fact, applicable.
And that the intent of those amendments were to do away with what the court had written and say and to expand the jurisdiction of the probate code because the legislature apparently believed that the court had been too restrictive in its interpretation of the statute. So the very purpose of the amendment was to expand the jurisdiction of the probate code courts and give the courts concurrent jurisdiction in these types of matters.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, let me say I don't think that was the intent. Now, there has been a lot of discussion about, particularly in the Pearson versus Kmart case, there was a lot of discussion about the court.
That's what the court said.
Yes. In fact,
they quoted the author.
That's right. The Houston court in that case, as this court knows, a very proactive court with regard to expansion of probate court jurisdiction, looked at the legislative history and said, well, what we think that they intended to do by, particularly by Representative Ickard's withdrawal of his objection, was that he conceded that the probate court jurisdiction should, in fact, be expanded. In fact, that's exactly opposite of what the Quest Court says in looking at the same legislative history. In looking at that legislative history, they said that while Representative Ickard did express, in fact, those very concerns that this was an attempt to expand the jurisdiction where any matter, and in fact, I think Representative Ickard in that case used the example of an antitrust matter might even be brought in probate court, which clearly should be a matter for the district courts, satisfied that that was not the intent of the drafters. That's when Representative Ickard withdrew his objection and satisfied that it was not an attempt to expand the jurisdiction, but rather to clarify, particularly with regard to the unliquidated claims language as used in say. Had the legislature had that intent, they could very well have done what they did in 1989, and that is specifically limit the language appertaining to and incident to in the 1989 amendments to the probate code, which clearly they did not do. Which I think is further evidence that that was not their intent in 1985, that is to expand the jurisdiction of the court to any matter which might tangentially touch on the issue of, might tangentially touch on the estate if it's raised by a personal representative of the estate or a claim made against a personal representative of the estate. That, in fact, such interpretation has been criticized by the courts below. I would further point out to the court that that Quest in the Quest discussion of the legislative history, and along with that discussion of the legislative history, the court in Quest said again emphasized that the controlling issue in the case must be one of the distribution, partition, or settlement of the estate. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
If I may, I want to spend just a minute in response to the position that the respondents have taken here today, and it really puzzles me. This cause of action in this case was a cause of action that was brought against the administrator and Mr. Cluck individually because of the manner in which this estate was handled while they were involved in the estate. And the specific allegations were that there were excessive fees charged by the estate plan that was implemented by Coble Wall Trust Company and drafted, admittedly, by Mr. Cluck. And that the administration of this estate under that entity and that individual resulted directly in the loss of assets, the substantial assets of this estate. And so the respondent's position to that, when a lawsuit is brought saying, basically, your actions have deprived this estate of all of the valuable assets that the estate owned, then the response is, well, there's no jurisdiction of the probate court here because there's no assets. There's nothing going on in this estate other than the litigation that ensued. And I think that that's a very important point. The litigation that resulted from this, from the administration of this estate by Coble Wall and Mr. Cluck, in both the Court of Appeals opinion and in the opening brief of the respondents in this court and the original appellants, there is admittedly the statement that at the instigation of the respondents here, that the probate court who tried this case took judicial notice of all of the probate files and of the file of the then case against Palmer versus San Antonio Savings. I think it's interesting to look at the Court of Appeals opinion when it talks about that other litigation. The Court of Appeals is talking about the subject matter jurisdiction question, and it addresses the other case, Palmer versus Sasson. On page 11 of the opinion, it says, under the same reasoning and procedure, the suit by these same plaintiffs against SASSA to set aside the foreclosure on the land, which comprised the bulk of the estate of Booney Moore, and return title to the estate, was properly transferred from the district court to the probate court, where probate proceedings of the estate were then pending. So after the asset, which comprised the bulk of the estate, has already been lost, which is what the Court of Appeals recognizes, the Court of Appeals states that it was proper for jurisdiction to attach to the Palmer versus Sasson case under the same circumstances in which the respondent herein argues that jurisdiction did not properly attach. In addition to that, there is another cause of action which is recited in the opening brief of the appellant herein involving the estate of Booney Moore. So we've got at least three active pending suits in which the estate of Booney Moore is a party during all relevant times that we're talking about.
So is it your contention that as long as the state includes a cause of action of any character, that the estate's open?
No, I think it's possible that the estate could be closed and the cause of action transferred to the beneficiaries. But I will say this, if this estate is closed, the only reason it's closed is because of that order of September of 1986. And I think it's clear, and again, I'm not sure that that order is before this court, but there is reference to it in the statement of facts. Mr. Cluck cross-examined Mr. Palmer about it. That might be at page 70 of volume 1. But I think it's clear that that order's purpose was not to end the existence of this estate. I think it's clear that that order's purpose was to terminate the temporary administration of Coble Wall Trust Company and to substitute for the temporary administration the independent administration of Mr. Bill Palmer, with all of the attendant obligations that he then had, two then pending suits, and this suit, which was clearly anticipated, as is evidenced by the testimony in this case, in addition to the dealings with the Internal Revenue Service, which were extensive, involving appraisals of both real estate and stock in the estate, not to mention the estate of Marie Davis. And I think it's interesting. I don't understand what the attack could possibly be. Opposing counsel has stated to this court, well, with regard to the estate of Marie Davis, that's not the estate that the trial court was dealing with. That was not the primary probate estate. None of the cases that the Court of Appeals cited and none of the cases that are cited in opposing counsel's brief delineate or restrict which estate that a cause of action can be appertaining to. The only relevant inquiry is there a pending active estate And then whatever test you pick, whether you pick the C versus Hall, direct relation to the distribution and accumulation of assets test, or it's the Farah versus Fashing augmentation of estate assets test, then you apply that test. And if the appropriate test applies, and if there's an active pending estate, I don't think there can be a proper assault on jurisdiction. And I certainly don't think that anybody could say that the estate of Marie Davis was languishing with no activity when the administrator of that estate was appointed at 10 o'clock a.m. the morning the jury selection in this cause of action started at 3 o'clock that afternoon, as is demonstrated by the record here.
Mr. Hall, assuming that the court agrees with your position, that this case have to be reversed and remanded to the Court of Appeals so that the Court of Appeals can address the points of error that were not addressed by the Court of Appeals.
Your Honor, as I read the Court of Appeals' opinion in that regard, the Court of Appeals, I think, overruled every point of error that was raised except for the points of error concerning the application of the Deceptive Trade Practice Act. And I think that all of those points of error pertaining to the Deceptive Trade Practice Act are no evidence points of error or matter of law points of error. So I think that this court could properly render judgment, assuming the jurisdiction attaches, by making a determination based upon the record before this court that the plaintiffs herein were consumers as defined in the DTPA and that there is evidence to support the DTPA cause of action. As I understand the Court of Appeals' opinion, and I can't represent to the court that it's clear in my mind, those are the only two issues that are left unresolved. So I think that rendition of judgment by this court, assuming the jurisdiction attaches, would be proper for that reason.
I know of no factual sufficiency points that were not reached by the Court of Appeals.
As I read the Court of Appeals' opinion, they were not. I think that the only issue before the Court of Appeals that was unresolved was the consumer status of the plaintiffs in the original cause of action, as I read the opinion. I think every other point of error was disposed of by the Court of Appeals.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the third clause and concludes the arguments for the day. The foregoing clause is submitted by brief and oral argument. Marshall will now plead during the court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.